sitting around as though as I was finding out everything I could about attempting sketches and filming. So you'll understand that I have a huge shared space of material, and I've only got half an hour to talk to you about it. So I've had to be very selective, and I've chosen some topics that I hope will give us an insight into daily life in the town. And I'll explain the title, Taking Candles to the Kirk. The background of this slide is a rather funny sketch of a church as it looked in the 17th century, although it's actually from a map that was made in 1771. During the winter, the church got very dark towards the end of the afternoon preaching, so the congregation were asked to bring candles with them to help light the place. This is the kind of detail that sometimes crops up in the otherwise routine business of the borough court or the council or the Kirk session, and gives us a glimpse of what daily life was like at the time. So let's start by thinking about candles. A very basic, everyday item. Of course, the candles we're talking about weren't the expensive wax ones that only the wealthy could afford. The candles made and sold in Dunfermline were tallow ones. Tallow is animal fat, and the hardest and best fat for candles is suet, which is the protective layer around the kidneys. However, the candle makers couldn't afford to be that choosy, and every kind of fat went into the melting pot. The scrapings from the hides being prepared for tanning, the fat trimmed from meat by the fleshers, anything a candle maker could get hold of, and not all of it terribly fresh either. Tallow boiling was a very smelly business, and it added its note to the rich aromas of Dunfermline, tanners, dyers, slaughterers, buyers, linens, and septic. I think if we went back to Dunfermline in the past, the first thing we'd do would be, oh my goodness. The wicks were linen, and the candles were made by repeated dipping in the molten fat. At the end of the dipping process, there'd be an accumulation of tallow at the base of the candle, so the wick didn't extend all the way down, in which case the surface should be removed. Of course, leaving it on increased the weight of the candle, and as they were sold by the pound, this was to the advantage of the seller, but no use to the buyer. And on several occasions, the town council had to remind the candle makers to make sure that the wick corresponded to the length of the candle. The price was regulated by the borough court, and it varied between 3 shillings and 4 shillings a pound. And that's Scots money, so if you're thinking about sterling, that would be threepence or fourpence. It was usually about 3 and 6, and I'm not going to go metric anywhere through this before because I don't know it. In 1692, the price was 4 shillings, and in the same year, 26 candles were bought for Dalgetty House for 8 and 8pence, and that makes them 4pence each. Of course, the very poor couldn't even afford 4pence for a candle, and they'd have relied on homemade rush lights or on cruisy lamps, or they'd just gone to bed very early. There is a tantalising reference to candles made specially for miners, but with no indication of what made them different, just that they were more difficult to make, and the candle makers asked the town council for permission to charge more than the regulation price for them, which was refused. There were usually about half a dozen candle makers in the town, and some of them were women, either the wives of merchants making candles as a sideline, or widows making them for a living. The very fact that six or so makers could provide enough candles for a town of about 500 households shows how few of the townspeople could actually afford them. Now let's have a look at the homes that were lighted by the candles. The evidence of the property records of the time is that a typical house consisted of a two-roomed ground floor with a corresponding first floor accessed by an external stair and a loft above that. Building plots were narrow, only about 20 feet wide, and they had to include at least a couple of feet for a passage for access to the yard. So rooms were small. Some houses had two back rooms, giving 4 rooms to a floor, and some were built on a double plot with a cut tunnel called a trans through the centre to give access to the yard behind, like that one. And of course, there was a humble single-storey cottages. The picture at the top left neatly illustrates both the one-storey and the two-storey houses. They're probably 18th rather than 17th century, but the building style has hardly changed over the years. The narrow house with the fourth stair in particular is in the 16th and 17th century style, and its next door neighbours is probably later because they seem to have internal stairs, which weren't only very posh houses in the 17th century had internal stairs. The house at bottom left is one of the exceptional high buildings that stood where Mark and Spencer married. It bore a 17th century date stone, but the drawing is 19th century, and by that time the house had been altered to include internal stairs. In the 17th century, a house of this height would have had an external turnpike to access the upper floors. The house at bottom right is a genuine 17th century survival, which you can see for yourself if you stand behind the bus station and look down to your left. It's been altered a lot, especially by the addition of a brick upper story in 1889, but the stone lower story is the remains of a house that is known to have been there in 1607, and probably for many years before that. It bore a date stone of 1636, but that wasn't the date of building. It was the year when its owner, James Reed, was first elected provost of Dunfermline. The remains of window lintels in the facade show that it had been a two-storey and a loft kind of house. And the 1854 OS map shows a fourth stair that's now gone. Now it has to be said that Dunfermline was a pretty tumble-down place. The word ruinous crops up rather frequently in property deeds. There were court cases about gables falling down in high winds, and on several occasions the town council ordered the owners of dilapidated houses to get them repaired. A house in the Collier Row, which is now Bruce Street, lay in ruin for at least a century and was used as an unofficial public lavatory until the town council had it boarded up to stop people getting in. Another large property in the High Street, more or less where Poundstretcher is now, was ruined for at least 40 years until the council took it over in 1710 and built a flesh and meal market on the site. Now, the Dunfermline wasn't alone in this. The problem was universal throughout Scotland. And in July 1644, the Scottish Parliament passed an act covering the whole country because, it said, upon the High Street of sundry of His Majesty's Barons Royal, there are many ruinous houses not inhabited these various years by God, and not likely to be repaired by any. And that, in public view of all people resorting to the said boroughs, to the opprobrium thereof, and the common scandal of this kingdom, as being defective of all policy and good order. Now the Act ordered all borough officials to make the owners of any buildings that had lain waste for at least 7 years repair them within a year and a day, or sell them to others who carry out the repairs. It also empowered the town councils to compulsorily purchase and repair tumble-down houses, but the catch did was that most councils didn't actually have the money to do it. Behind the houses were plots of various sizes. Property deeds just called them yards, which can mean either a garden or a space used for various ancillary buildings and workshops. The yard behind James Reed's house in the High Street, for instance, contained a malt barn, a feed farm, byres, stables, lofts, and a hen house, and this was probably typical of the contents of the larger yards. On the other hand, when the gable of Robert Fraser's house in the Kirkgate collapsed into his neighbour's yard in 1609, it damaged some fruit trees. And when Fraser was granted access to rebuild his gable, he was warned not to damage any of the herbs and kale growing in the yard. Kale, of course, was ubiquitous. In 1649, Helen Kinghorn paid part of her debt to a dyer for two roots of kale worth 13 and 14. merchants sold onions for even half a pound at a time. So an awful lot of onions must have been grown. Of course, these were sillies, like large spring onions. The kind of onions we use in cooking today were imported in barrels from the Netherlands, and Dunfermline merchants shipped them to Leith and sold them there, no doubt bringing some home to sale in the town. Onion seed was bought from specialist growers, but other seeds would have been saved from a man-grown plant. In 1620, an Everton man, who seems to have been running a market garden, sold 2 ounces of parsley seed for 20 pence, and whoever bought that was going to grow a heck of a lot of parsley, and 2 ounces of kale seed for 2 shillings. He also sold 150 plants of some unspecified species for 3 shillings, and half a peck of something that a clerk wrote as supermat, which I meant to take to mean spearmint. An apple tree grew in the yard of a ruinous tenement in the High Street, and there were espalier fruit trees in the former Abbey garden. The gardener bought nails to fix them to the walls. In the 1660s, a widow who owned a large yard about halfway down the west side of the New Road, letting it out in 6 allotments of 2 rooms each, about 180 square feet. And that was enough space to grow a lot of kale and sillies. Some people would be glad to have half of that to their back garden instead. Moving on from horticulture to agriculture, Dunfermline was a very rural town. With only about 250 houses, it was really a large village. And anyone who could manage it would buy or lease some agricultural land to grow crops. The nearest arable area was what then was called the Holmback, and is now a public park, and the old ploughing rigs were still very visible there. The picture is the man who farmed, the men who farmed in the Holmback owned their land, and there were some other privately owned fields to the north of the town. But most people leased a few acres on one of the nearby estates. In 1619, for instance, the owner of Baldridge took 34 tenants to court for payment of their rent, all of them Dunfermline men. Many of them were merchants, but there were also tailors, dyers, smiths, wrights, and other tradesmen in the list. This agricultural activity was so important that on one occasion, two former prophets at the town took each other to court in a dispute over the ownership of a muck heap. The main crops were oats, and very spiky six-rowed barley or bear, perhaps different from the modern two-rowed barley. You can see the difference there. Most of the barley was used for brewing, and the oats, of course, were ground for oatmeal. Very little wheat was grown because it's a hungry crop, and most of the arable land available to the townsmen lay to the north of the town, where the soil was too poor to support wheat. One man did grow some in a yard in the Netherton, but he ended up being taken to court by his landlord for growing a crop that would impoverish the soil. As well as cereals, they also grew field beans and peas. Yes, beans and peas. Not for eating fresh, but for drying and cooking or grinding to add to oatmeal. I've included this picture of the field beans because, although the man is obviously is a modern one, he's holding the kind of size that you can use to farm. Like cereals, you can be just back before they dry and then threshed out for further drying in a kiln, and the waste was used for animal feed. The yield of cereals was unbelievably low, only fourfold or less, and a quarter of that had to be saved for next year's seed. As the rents, or farms as they were called, were paid in grain and were often quite high, one wonders why people bothered to farm at all. Harvest time was an important season of the year, both for the farmers and for the poor, as they could earn a few shillings and make a dream in the cut fields. They were often fed by the farmer and given a bounty of a peck or two of grain. There are occasional mentions of the punishment of a wrongdoer being delayed until they've got their harvest in. There were also some arable areas in the townland, the northeast of the borough. Now, a lot more research is needed to pinpoint the exact divisions of the townland, and that's one of the things I've got on the back burner at the moment. But it seems that there was a major division more or less along the King Street Road, which is the red line there. And the area to the south being mainly arable and the ones to the north being Norman, the town muir. The muir did contain fields, but they were probably used for grazing rather than as perfect arable land. They were often leased by local fleshers, presumably to fatten the cattle for slaughter. Now this map was made in 1829, by which time most of the moorland had been converted to arable and Townhill Woods had been planted all over the rest of it. The area outlined in red at the top right hand corner was added in the 18th century, but the map does show roughly the situation in the 17th century. Working from south to north, first came the town green, down here. It's a lot smaller on that map because it has shrunk by then. That stretched from the head of the Whole Bank, which is now the public park, northward to a line behind the present Leeds Park care home, and from east to west, the green started at Townhill Road and included what's now the western half of the cemetery. North of the town green was an open field called Dawes Dean, which was divided into strips that were leased out by the town council. Between Dawes Dean and King Street Road was an area of enclosed fields, also leased out by the council, and there were more fields to the west of Townhill Road. Now these fields have names that are now lost: Peacocks, Hoggins, Langlands, Nichols, Thornhill, Heathery, Crossfields, Brunel Deals, Lammerbutts, Brayfields, Greenreath, Tunney Field. One day I hope I'll be able to identify them. The moorland was heavily used, most obviously as a source of heather for firing, malting and drying kilns, and for heated bread ovens. The bakers had a big problem, because there was practically no firewood to be had locally, and coal and peat were no good for firing the beehive ovens that they used. Dojettes were allowed an allocation of a certain number of horse loads of heather per year, but bakers were allowed extra. It is often said that heather was used for thatching, but the only natural roofing material mentioned in any of the 17th century Dunfermline records is turf. There were peat cuttings in the muir, but as they were free to everyone, they aren't often mentioned in the borough records, although towards the end of the century the town council made an effort to regulate their use. Apart from the heather, turf and peat, the other resource that the muir provided was grazing land for the town's cows. Each owner was allowed grazing for one cow, for which he paid a fee, and every spring the town council appointed an official herdsman, whose job it was during the summer to collect all the cows from their individual byres in the morning, take them to the muir and watch them to make sure they didn't fall into pits or eat any crops, and then bring them home in the evening. The town green was also used for grazing. There are no figures for the numbers of cows involved in the 17th century, but then in the next century, the town council began to keep official lists of owners each year, and there were usually about 80 cows, with two herdsmen to look after them. In 1673, the borough began to explore the muir as a whole. The first bit was planted in the northwest corner of the townland, more or less where the map shows the small rectangular area of woodland there. This area proved to be too wet, and after a few years, the site was changed to one near the eastern boundary of Whitefield. Exactly where on the boundary the pits were located is so far unknown, but the council was in constant dispute with the laird over a mutual drainage level between their respective coal works. At the same time as the town began coal mining, it also began to consolidate some of its fields into small farms, which were leased to farmers who had to design the land and bring it into cultivation. The soil of the open field at Dawes Dean had by this time become so impoverished that strip by strip have been allowed to revert to grassland for Leeds. And I think this is the origin of the place name Leeds Park. Of course, we can't say anything about the history of Dunfermline without mentioning women. In the 17th century, weavers outnumbered all the other trades. Dunfermline merchants were among the many staffs who came to Dunfermline by reading the flax, fairs and spinning, and shipping it home to be spun and woven. Much of the linen was then shipped down to London for sale. This trade flourished until the fire of 1624 put an end to it. Some flax was grown in and around the town, but nowhere near enough to supply the weavers, so Danzig lint continued to be used. But after 1624, Dunfermline's merchants bought their supplies from the merchants and skippers of other towns. The weavers made linen of various kinds, but the one I want to concentrate on today is the fabric of dawning. This was an early form of simple damask type weaving that had evolved from the diagonal twill technique, and there's a twill woven piece of modern fabric there, and originated in the Flemish town of Tournai. Dunfermline had links with Tournai in the 15th century, and by the 17th century, Dornick weaving was well established in the town. Broad Dornick was made into tablecloth and narrow Dornick into table napkins. The slide shows medieval kings and noblemen dining at tables spread with Dornick cloth, and the background is the kind of patterns that could be woven in the technique. And you may notice that on this one, the king or the lord has got the more elaborate diagonal pattern, and the lower orders have just got squares on those. of course, it was only the most skilled weavers who wove Dornick, and one of them, called George Sturt, made yards of it for the Countess of Tweedale. Lesser mortals used local Dornick for their best table linen. The poor, of course, were lucky if they had a table to eat off, let alone a plant to put on it. It was this background of centuries of complex weaving that was the impetus behind the introduction of damask into Dunfermline in 1718. James Blake, who introduced the damask loom to the town, was building on skills he'd learned as an apprentice in Dunfermline. The process wasn't entirely new to the town's weavers, but was a refinement and progression of skills that had been established here for centuries. Of course, none of this was possible without the constant labour of the women of the town, spinning the yarns that the weavers used. Before spinning began, the lint would be combed out to straighten the fibres and separate out the coarse from the fine. The coarse fibres were called hards, and they were woven into a fabric called harding that was used to make clothes and sheets for the poor, and for servants, and for the third best to table linen. The finer lint was spun for weaving into better bed and table linen, and clothing for the better off. Wool was also spun, mostly for weaving into hodden grey cloth, planning, blankets, and bed covers. Women who could afford them usually had both a wool and a linen spinning wheel, and one woman also had a wheel for spinning worsted, which is a fine yarn spun from long fibre wool. I have no idea what the difference was between the different types of wheels, although lint wheels cost from 2 to 5 times as much as wool wheels. Also, there's no indication as to whether the wheels were of the early type that were turned by hand, and there's there, or the more sophisticated ones that had a treadle. I suspect the first, because I don't think the treadle ones were introduced into Scotland until the 18th century, but I really couldn't swear to that. Relatively few people could afford a spinning wheel. This staff would have been the main means of making yarn, and they were used even by women who owned spinning wheels. The picture at bottom left of a woman asleep by the fire with her distaff, there it is, pops up beside her, is actually 15th century, but it could be of any age up to the mid-18th. As well as being cheap, probably handmade, These staffs were portable and could be used on the long walks that women had to make when they were moving from place to place. When Agnes Drysdale and her husband separated in 1659, their agreement about the household items he allowed her to take with her included the best lint wheel, the distaff and spindle, the reel onto which the yarn was wound to make a hat, and all her unworked yarn, toes, roots, and wool. I have to say that they were separated because she'd had an affair with an English officer who was quartered on them during the occupation. But and you don't sort of think, you know, that scarlet or something like that, but she did. A hank of yarn sold for 6 shillings, but it could also be wound onto a large spindle, which sold for between £1 and 30 shillings. Merchants bought lint in huge quantities. One who died in 1605 had more than a ton of it in his boots. They needed a good supply because although most women bought between 8 and 16 pounds at a time, some bought as much as 64 pounds. The price varied between £2.13 and £4 and £5 a stone of 16 pounds, presumably according to the quality of the needle. Sometimes the yarn was given to a weaver who was then paid for working it into household fabrics. Yarn surplus to household requirements was sold to weavers who then wove and sold the cloth on their own account. In some cases, a weaver or merchant supplied the lint and paid the women for spinning it. All the women in a household spun, wives, daughters, servants. They took up their distaff or sat down at their wheels in much the same way as many women used to pick up a piece of knitting when they had nothing else to do. Still with family matters, let's turn to education. This slide shows the progression from the village school, in this case the Dame school, because that's the only picture at the time, through the grammar school to St Andrews University. The account book set from 1681 to 1691 by the Pitcairnie farmer Thomas Anderson followed the whole process, although only one of his sons went through all the stages. In 1681, his eldest son, John, aged 14, was in his final year at the grammar school. In the autumn of 1682, John was apprenticed to his uncle, Alexander Anderson, who was a dyer in King Rock. Alexander died 6 months later, and by the end of May, John had been apprenticed to a Dunfermline baker, and he went on to make it his trade. In 1681, Thomas's eldest daughter Elizabeth, aged 8, was at a local school run by Thomas Douglas, and she stayed there until May 1682. At the beginning of June 1684, she started at a school run by Barbara Smeaton. Thomas Junior, aged 6, was with Elizabeth at Thomas Douglas's school in 1681. At the end of May 1683, he joined the grammar school, and he was there until August 1687. He seems to have been the clever one in the family, because at the age of 12 he went to St Andrews University, where he studied under a succession of tutors until the spring of 1690, and he didn't graduate. His Latin essay book is now held at the National Records of Scotland in Edinburgh. On the 1st of April 1690, now aged 15, he moved to the Dunfermline Music School and was there for at least a year. Nothing more is heard of Thomas Jr. until 1697, when his father died and he became a burgess and member of the guildry and took over a brewing and innkeeping business in Crossford that his father had established. Thomas Anderson's third son, Charles, started at the Fitzgerald Village School in November 1683 at the age of 6, and joined Thomas at Grammar School in June 1685, leaving in February 1689. He and Thomas boarded at Dunfermline with a relative, Janet Anderson, during the winter months. After leaving the Grammar School, Charles probably joined his father on the farm, as he was the tenant there in 1607, along with his brother William. The fourth son, Patrick, also he had a load of children, His fourth son Patrick also started at the Pitcairn School at the age of six in September 1686. He went to the grammar school at the beginning of April 1688, but he doesn't seem to have done very well because he left at the beginning of June to have private Latin lessons at Pitcairn. William, the fifth son, just right, so I've only got 2 minutes left. Started at Pitcairn at the age of five in April 1688. In May 1691, he transferred to Grizzle Tillidas School, where his younger brother James, aged six, started at the same time. There were two more children, but they were too young to be included in the account that ended in 1691. The Anglican children demonstrate a range of educational paths, from Elizabeth 2 or 3 years at a village school or a lane school, to Thomas's 10-year scholastic career, moving from village school to grammar school to university to music school, and ending up as a highly educated brewer and innkeeper in a small village. And here, we have the famous picture of 1692. We've only scratched the surface of life in the town, but you can always read the book when it comes out. But I hope the scratches will reveal something of what it was like to live here 400 years ago.